Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Penelope Plaza, who is a lecturer in architecture at the University of Reading, about her new book, Culture as Renewable Oil, How Territory, Bureaucratic Power, and Culture Coalesce in the Venezuelan Petrostate. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave.
This is a really interesting book that covers both a really important case study in Venezuela, also has lots of relevance to how we understand culture, but I guess has got this really kind of crucial intervention in how we understand oil states, petrostates, and the idea of kind of the oil culture in which, to an extent, I guess, all of us still live. And the place to start, I suppose, is where your interest in both the Venezuelan kind of context, but also writing about this idea of the culture of oil came from?
Well, the interest came from first from my activity as an urban activist. Aside from my academic work in Venezuela, I was part of a collective doing urban interventions in the public space. And in the way that culture is managed and regarded, I felt that in contemporary accounts of Venezuelan culture, sometimes that sort of that the petrostate got taken for granted, and I realized that unless you told the story of oil, sort of the story of how Venezuelan culture, contemporary culture, came to be, something was missing from the whole story, I guess, and also because it's embedded in everything. So the reason why we have museums, why we have infrastructure, why we have social housing is all because we are a petrostate.
I'm really interested in this because the book, I guess, starts from the idea that we're really used to talking about oil and the economy. We're used to talking about maybe oil company or, you know, petrochemical companies' influence on politics. Obviously, at the moment, we've got, you know, big debates about environmentalism and you know, kind of our oil dependence. But you're really keen to kind of foreground the idea that actually we should be thinking about oil and culture, you know. So you mentioned, like, you know, museums and the kind of culture we have and oil. But I guess one of the key things is in the book is the way you talk about this cultural dimension of oil and the idea that culture is a kind of a resource, a bit like hydrocarbons, a bit like oil. So it'd be good to start with, I guess, those two things. On the one hand, the idea of culture as a resource that might be a bit like oil, and then on the other hand, the cultural dimension of oil.
Well, in the cultural resource, there the work of George Giudice was very helpful because, you know, in a way, what he establishes in the spirit of culture, I expanded to the idea of culture pretty much like a mineral resource. Because I have to include a bit of history here that people need to understand that as Venezuela was becoming a new nation, that's when we also discovered oil. So statecraft became completely enmeshed with the oil industry. So everything that is contemporary modern culture is also embedding this idea of the age of oil. And also that meant that the way that social relations and politics were formed are inseparable from the culture of oil. So in that sense, then culture is kind of a resource, kind of also like a mineral resource that is utilized for social and political purposes that then is not able to be separated from oil. But there's also a very contradictory, ambivalent relationship with oil, because on the one sense, it's all encompassed with tropes of being magical, of giving you powers to transform the country like almost overnight with the immediate influx of money that pretty much flows straight from the ground into the state's coffers. But there's also this longstanding narrative that was materialized in anthropologist Rodolfo Quintero's work in his essay titled The Culture of Oil, where he defined the culture of oil as a foreign force of conquest that brings its own language, technology, inventions, that what it does is destroy the national indigenous culture to substitute it with this cultural oil that is all about the oil business. So for him, all camps were colonizing forces and oil cities were cities that were sterile, but there was also a very Manichaean view of culture, where you have on the one side the indigenous national, you could say traditional culture, and on the other hand all the modern contemporary culture that came with oil that is equated with the American way of life. And that thing, that dichotomy, has been quite prevalent all through the history in Venezuela, how we relate with this sort of very difficult to unpack relationship with culture and oil.
Yeah, I mean the book makes the point quite forcefully that this isn't like a new thing. You know, it's not something that's just kind of sprung up since the Bolivarian Revolution. Actually, this is something that has a really long history, and the idea of kind of Venezuela as an oil state is something that, in some ways, is kind of baked into to everything about the nation, irrespective of who's in power. And it'd be great to hear, I guess, briefly about that kind of history and the continuities, you know, even within the sort of Chavez and then, you know, that kind of more recent era, that there are still these kind of continuities of the primacy of oil to the Venezuelan state.
Yeah, I guess that's what also taking the cultural approach to looking at oil means, that it made it very clear that the Bolivarian Revolution didn't bring such a point of rupture as being established, at least in the way that it relates to oil. So I think just roughly I would organize sort of the history of Venezuela as an oil state into three big periods, which would start with the emergence of the modern oil nation, like from early 20th century to 1958, which was when Marcos Pérez Jiménez dictatorship was overthrown. And it's sort of the period in which Fernando Coronil defines the Venezuelan petrostate as this magical state that tends to rule more based on a sense of wonder than of reason, and when all the powers tends to be concentrated in the figure of the president. Then will be the Pact of Punto Fijo era, or the Punto Fijismo petrostate, that will go run through 1959 to the 1970s, and including the 1970s oil booms up until 1998. And then the Chavez era of petrosocialism, which will encompass his presidency, and that's where the book ends, like 1999 to 2013, with Chavez's death. So I already explained briefly that we can't separate Venezuelan statecraft from the development of the oil industry. Also because oil companies, when they came to Venezuela was a quite poor country with a lot of deficiencies. So a lot of the infrastructure that the state should I be able to build? Those resources came from the foreign companies. So those were the ones that built highways, that built churches, that built housing. So there was this sense that oil meant modernity and progress. But also what I explained before, this ambivalent relationship, a lot of the elites saw oil with suspicion because they regarded it as an ephemeral source of wealth that you couldn't really quantify because it was hidden on the ground. So there's another continuity here with this idea that I also planned in the book, with to sow the oil, which was a slogan coined by intellectual Arturo Uslar Pietri, saying that we should use the wealth produced by this destructive mineral economy to modernize the agricultural industry. So it's sort of conflating mining and agricultural language so as to sow the oil as a seed and harvest progress, but just to modernize the agricultural economy. And that's going to be a slogan, an idea that will keep being relief, whether we have managed to sow the oil or not. And that sort of runs through the whole history of contemporary Venezuela, or even up to the point of Chavez's presidency.
So these ideas of both continuity and then particular, I guess, you know, cultural tropes like sowing the oil are framed through two really big kind of theoretical ideas that the book uses, and you talk about these two ideas quite kind of early on to help us understand the petrostate and these, you know, kind of long continuities, and these are bureaucratic power and then the idea of territory. And I guess we need to know a bit about both of them before we start talking about the specific case studies that you've got of the state oil company and some of its cultural practices. So yeah, what do you mean by territory and bureaucratic power?
Well, territory is crucial for the book because, you know, the power of the state, which I explain how I mean by bureaucratic power, derives from having control over the oil rent. And control over the oil rent means that you have to have ownership of all the subsoil of the country. So that means that you have a landlord rentier state, to which its power is tied to the land. So I developed my ideas on territory from Neil Brenner and Elden's reading of Lefebvre on this idea of a state space as territory. Because just in the way that, you know, that you could say that the oil in the subsoil was a pre-given for Venezuela, but then having access to that oil wells in the subsoil is what then constituted the Venezuelan petrostate. So I thought that Lefebvre's idea of state space as territory was very important to build that argument because, in a way, he says that the territory is not a sort of pre-given form, that in a way there is no state without territory and no territory without without a state, that they constitute each other through different circumstances in history and ways of making politics, which I think is very important to understand, particularly when you're talking about a petrostate where the economy is really tied to the ground. And that's where bureaucratic power comes in, because then that means that the state does not exercise power by itself. It's more like an institutional ensemble. And if we look back at the way that the statecraft was emerging in Venezuela in early 20th century, it was modeled based on the bureaucracy efficiency brought by the foreign oil companies, because if we did not have a, in a way, a process of developing efficiency bureaucracy given to all the deficiencies that we had as an agricultural economy. So that's where those two come together, viewing bureaucratic power as the site where the state congregates an ensemble of institutions where it's based on those people who are able to act through the bureaucratic power that then will be able to explain what I talked about later about the way Hugo Chavez was able to centralize bureaucratic power into his presidency, and then PDVSA also being able to function, which is the state-owned oil company, to function as kind of a state within the state or a parallel state with its own territory and bureaucratic power running through all this narrative.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, PDVSA is crucial to this entire story. And I guess you've hinted there actually that it gives us a way of making clear how ideas about territory and bureaucratic power work in your book. So what is it like, you know, I guess we think in some ways of like, you know, companies as these organizations that have, you know, actions and do things, but you tell the story of PDVSA as almost, I guess, a kind of like an alternative state within Venezuela. And I guess it'd be really kind of crucial that we understand what it is and what it was able to do as well.
Okay, so I guess in very simple terms, it's the state-owned oil company that was created in 1975 during the presidency of Carlos Andrés Pérez, right after the law that nationalized the oil, aluminum, and other basic industries. So it has been quite prevalent in the way that the economy has functioned since then, because it was created at a time of oil windfall. And it has become, in a way, the main source of income of the state. So it is quite crucial to understand PDVSA as central to the bureaucratic power of the state and the way that it has shaped politics and relationships. And because it inherited, because what it did sort of absorb the former sort of U.S. Oil companies into a conglomerate that it was owned by the state. So it inherited all its bureaucratic efficiency. So when compared to other apparatus of the government, so it really was like the gem of the nation, and it became an aspirational place to work. It became an exemplar of what Venezuela could be, but also as time progressed and oil executives in PDVSA tried to internationalize the oil company and make it more, you know, in the realm of BP and other international oil companies, it started to become like a state within the state, where you had like a very wealthy state institution in the midst of a third world country, which was begun to be heavily criticized in the 80s and the 90s in the midst of crashing oil prices. So how it was sort of kept separate from the state, and saying that all of their policy of internalization and getting some tax exemptions meant that impoverished the state, and as a byproduct, impoverished quality of living for most of the population. So that's also then why PDVSA became quite prominent during the revolution, and why Chavez then completely refashioned the channeling of resources from PDVSA into the government, so as to have a more direct relationship between the people and the oil rent.
What's the cultural story? Later on in the book, you sort of move away from, I guess, the that political or political economy story of PDVSA and its relationship to the state, and you, if you'll excuse the pun, drill down into the cultural story here. And I guess there's a couple of things going on. One is the visual language of PDVSA.
Yeah.
And the other is a particular kind of cultural set of projects. So maybe we'll do the latter first. Like, what are the cultural dimensions of PDVSA's work?
Well, with the access, you know, to the oil rent, PDVSA, like any other big corporation, also had its cultural arm, which in this case, you know, PDVSA had always sort of been patron of arts exhibitions and art publishing, literature. But in the 1980s, it created something called La Estancia Arts Center, which, with a revolution after the oil strikes of 2002, was renamed PDVSA La Estancia, the social control arm of the new revolutionary PDVSA. And that's where the book centers its attention. La Estancia has its headquarters in Caracas. And also, by being the social control arm of PDVSA, so it has direct access to the oil rent in a way that other cultural institutions don't. And I guess part of the story that I'm not going to delve too much into detail here was that with this importance of territory, the oil windfall that the revolution enjoyed in the mid-2000s meant that Chavez could embark on a mission of refashioning the state and creating new forms of territorial governance. That meant there were all kinds of legal vacuums that were left that PDVSA La Estancia, claiming to be part of the law of hydrocarbons and being part of this 25-year-old plan that Chavez launched in 2005 called Sowing Oil Plan, meant that they could regard themselves as a national institution that could surpass the authority of other sort of cultural and heritage institutions. That meant that they could then decide to take on work that other institutions could not embark on in a similar way.
Could you give some examples of that?
For example, PDVSA La Estancia presents itself as having different branches. So one of the key work that they started doing was restoring a lot of the modern public artwork that was scattered all over Caracas that had been falling in complete disrepair. So like the Sphere by Jesus Soto and the Policromia by Cruz Diez, who are quite iconic public artworks that were installed in the city in the 1970s, which are symbols of the modern oil nation. They took on the restoration of those works, but also took on the regeneration of Sabana Grande Boulevard and opening new art centers across the country as part of PDVSA. And the general manager at the time, sort of put forward the slogan saying that PDVSA La Estancia is oil that harvests culture, as if all these cultural sort of objects and sculptures and artworks were sort of proof that, you know, when you plant the seed of oil, you can harvest culture in the city.
I mean, obviously there are like various critical elements we could bring to that, particularly in our current context, you know.
Yeah.
As we're talking, we've just seen, you know, the end of a couple of weeks of interventions in London by Extinction Rebellion protesters, and you know the nature of a sort of, you know, a culture based on petrostate income and sustainability is obviously a really crucial and critical moment. But I think what's also interesting has been your analysis of I guess, how this relationship manifested itself visually. So in the book, you talk about the kind of, you know, discourses and the discursive relationships between sowing the oil, harvesting the cultural benefits of the oil. But there are also like distinctive visual interventions that really kind of shape, I suppose, the visual, like the visual culture of Venezuela and, you know, Caracas in a couple of your examples. And you start the book with this being struck by basically a big advert. And also you kind of close the book with it as well. So it'd be great to hear about, the kind of the visual elements as well as that, you know, discursive connection that you've already pointed to.
Well, the adverts are quite crucial. Unfortunately, I didn't get permission to reproduce them in the book, but they're still found online. And the thing what struck me was that just as I mentioned these two sort of great pieces of public art by Soto and Cruzies, the adverts were put on one of these petrol stations where you usually would see just adverts for lubricants and, you know, sort of boring stuff. It had a giant old worker all dressed in red, sort of placing this public art as if they were miniatures. But not just, that was already striking, but what struck me the most was the slogan. As the slogan says, we transform oil into a renewable resource for you, leaving it sort of open-ended as to what that renewable resource is. But when you see the series of adverts that have all kinds of female and male giant oil workers placing like miniaturized versions of these pieces all over the city, you see all of them are public arts, playgrounds, sculptures, 19th century gazebos in the park. And in a way, sort of leaving to understand that all those things that are part of the culture of the city are there because oil made them possible. That renewable resource, in a way, it's culture itself. So there, that's why I proposed this notion of culture as renewable oil, meaning that as a trope, and with continuing to play on this sowing oil slogan, what the revolution does and what PDVSA La Estancia does in particularly is to say that they have achieved the utopian dream because they are harvesting it. And the way you harvest the sowing oil is by producing cultural objects.
I mean, it seems... might editorialize a little. It seems ludicrous now that we'd have this sort of connection, and particularly as we're seeing across America and Britain and actually many other countries, demands that culture is, you know, radically disconnected from oil, particularly in terms of oil sponsorship and things like this. And I guess it prompts the question of how a petrostate might disconnect itself from this, not just reliance on oil, but the idea of, you know, oil bringing these kind of cultural benefits. I suppose there are similar debates in the Gulf with, you know, the kind of new museums program and that kind of stuff. And so, we could use the example of Venezuela, but we can also use other examples. Obviously, the book concentrates on Venezuela, but what kind of future do you conceive of for petrostates and culture in the context of, you know, not just the institutions, but the visual language and the political discourses being so dependent on this kind of, you know, supposedly benevolent relationship with oil?
Well, the key thing for sort of petrostates is whether, you know, the petrostate, like their interior economy, can, you know, be able to coexist with other forms of, economic income. Because the key thing on Venezuela, I think it might be also the case with countries that depend on oil, like the Gulf or even Nigeria, or sort of Indonesia, is that in the case of Venezuela, which is the one that I know best, oil nation is also a national identity. It's sort of part of what, you know, the pride of being part of that country is that you have this wealth that is hidden on your underneath your feet. That meant that you were particularly lucky compared with other countries. So there is a myth then to break there that, you know, having, you know, oil in the subsoil does not make you a wealthy country. It can make for a wealthy state, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that wealth is invested wisely. So when I see those requests of not having dirty oil money, on culture coming from the temple where I come from, where if it hadn't been for the oil wealth, we wouldn't have, you know, like public education, we wouldn't be able to have public universities, museums, cultural infrastructure that Venezuela enjoyed up until the 90s and in some way it still does. It's quite difficult, so it does require a lot of a nuanced conversation as to how do you put in under control an economy that is dependent on a mineral resource that when it goes well, you can have an instant windfall that completely disturbs the mechanisms of sort of politics, of a social contract, and how can you find alternative sources of income that will mean that, you know, that the state and the population will have a different relationship to this sort of social contract politics and how culture is embedded within those dynamics. So in a country like Venezuela, where the oil industry is like, you know, in the DNA of statecraft, I find it quite difficult because you can also see like younger political leaders not being able to imagine the country as anything other than a petrostate. So it is a debate that needs to happen, but it's on the practical level how that takes place, where also oil rent money gives so much benefits in terms of politics and control of territory and being having access to a direct source in which you don't have to, I mean, as a state, as a government, you don't need to reach consensus because you have direct access to the, you know, to the rent money. It's, you know, it is quite complicated. Something that I think has been a complex debate that I think has been oversimplified.
In terms of this complex debate, is this what you're going to be intervening in with your future work? Or have you sort of had enough about writing about oil states and are you going to be doing different things and working on different themes?
Well, I think I'm going to be taking a little break. I will be going back to it. But right now, having looked at this from, if you know, like from the macro structure of the petrostate and culture, I want to look at what happens in the detail, in the day-to-day life. And in that, I want to look at the work of urban activists and creative practice in how do you contest or navigate you know, the legacy, the cultural legacy, particularly in terms of architecture and public art, as an individual, as organized people, particularly since a lot of the social infrastructure that Venezuelans enjoyed have collapsed because of mismanagement and the crash in oil prices. So it will remain a part of the narrative, but I want to look at something different in the sense of how that affects lived experience. As a way for individuals to organize themselves to create sort of infrastructure that are not so heavily dependent on, like a protective father-like petrostate, and see whether there is some kind of keys that could be extracted there of what kind of future a country like Venezuela would have from that point of view.